I am Plantal the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Canada means a lot of things to a lot of people, but a common way this country has been understood and thought of are the symbols of the country, logos, objects, concepts that fill the public space and consciousness. They define the country to others outside Canada, but just as much to ourselves. A new book looks at the various symbols. There are about 23, each with an essay from exploring its origin, its impact, and just what makes them iconic. Michael Dawson is one of the editors of the book. He joins me now. I'll get him to tell us about the essays, their contributors, and these potent symbols that mean so much, from the beaver to the canoe to the flag, our national anthem, totem poles, hockey, Tim Hortons, and others. There are many concepts that say Canada. Michael Dawson is a professor of history at St. Thomas University. He edited this book with Catherine Gidney and Donald Wright. The book is published by Between the Lines. Please welcome to the Plantal the Line program in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Michael Dawson. Professor Dawson, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So the symbols in the book, these are ones that have shaped the country and to various degrees. How did you get to 23, though?
Difficult task. Lots of discussion, lots of fun discussion. I think at one point we had a quote-unquote short list of 35, and then we whittled away. We had to wave goodbye to the Rocky Mountains. We had to discard the CN Tower, the grain elevator, and I think we've probably lost a few friends because curling did not make it in. Instead, it was lacrosse and hockey in terms of sports. But we were trying to come up with a decent balance between symbols that are still very much recognized amongst the vast majority of the populace, and maybe some symbols that used to be more popular than they are today. And then we are also, trying to find something of a regional balance. You can't have a perfect balance, but so there were a lot of different factors that went into this.
Well, what makes a symbol say become not unpopular, but lose its sort of symbolism over the years?
Yeah, good question. It varies according to different symbols. So you take for instance the Canadian Pacific Railway, right? Completed in 1885. Seen very much as a triumph of Canadian engineering, and mm-hmm. seen and celebrated at the time as something that was uniting the country and really making the country a viable economic proposition. Late 19th, early 20th century, it would be celebrated in books and films and that sort of thing. And yet, over time, as we move further and further away from that key moment of achievement, the memories start to fade. But the other thing that happens with the Canadian Pacific Railway, of course, is that it might be seen at the time as as something of a national success story, but from a regional point of view, it's also the source of alienation and mm-hmm. angst. So there are plenty of farmers on the prairies from the 1880s through to the 1920s. Who feel victimized by the Canadian Pacific Railway as a corporation that is not really helping them survive as farmers in terms of trying to get their wheat to the market.
And it's still a part of our consciousness. If you take Vancouver from where I'm calling you from today, I'm sure it's like that in other cities where, the streets are named after people, who are part of the CPR officials at the time.
Absolutely, absolutely. So there's still this sort of remnant of sort of public memory and historical memory that's there, like you say, in street signs. But given the way in which we transport ourselves across the country and around the globe, there isn't probably as much focus on railways as there was in the past. So the CPR struck us as one that used to be quite popular, very much a reference point for Canadian identity, and even into the 1960s and 70s, uh-huh. you had Gordon Lightfoot singing about the Canadian Pacific Railway. But, looking at what happens in terms of change over time with some of these symbols, we found quite revealing.
When you look back to say what the oldest symbol might be, is there one? I'm thinking, was it the beaver, say?
I think it could be. We had a little conversation about that last week. One person was arguing for the beaver, the other one was arguing for the fleur-de-lis. Mm-hmm. Now, the fleur-de-lis, of course, is imported from Europe, whereas the beaver, of course, is exported from Canada. So I would probably think in terms of, you know, the origins of a species, probably the beaver itself predates the fleur-de-lis. So I'll lean in that direction.
Yeah, the fascinating thing about the fleur-de-lis, though, is that for some people it's more Quebec than Canada, and at times in our history it's been a potent symbol for suggesting the breakup of the country.
Yes, absolutely. So the fleur-de-lis is interesting that way, in the sense that in terms of colonization and the colony of New France, it's adopted as a symbol of the French regime, and then after the conquest of Quebec in 1759, the French Canadian population there doesn't hold on to the fleur-de-lis as tightly as they had previously. Instead, they seem to focus more in terms of symbolism on the maple leaf. Mm-hmm. But then there's a shift a little later on as English Canadians focus more and more on the maple leaf as a symbol of a pan-Canadian identity. Then French Canadians or Quebecois sort of return to their focus on the fleur-de-lis. And then as we move into the sovereignty movement of the 1960s and 70s, you can really see the fleur-de-lis being connected to a sense of Quebecois rather than Canadian identity.
Do Americans, for example, do they go through sort of this revising, revision, or rethinking of their symbols, like whether it's the flag or apple pie or the eagle, say? Do they go through the same things?
Good question. I think we can see it a little bit. Certainly, one of the commonalities in terms of symbolism between these two, Canada, the United States, but all countries really, is the anthem, right? Mm-hmm. And anthems are interesting in the sense that they start off drawing upon other symbols like a flag or for Canada, the North and that sort of thing. But then the anthems themselves become symbolic, because of course we invest something of ourselves in them, in the songs, in the tunes, in the lyrics, when we stand and sing them at hockey games or school assemblies and that sort of thing. And I think the dispute over the past 3 or 4 years with Colin Kaepernick, I think there are interesting parallels between what's been happening in the United States in terms of the symbolism of the anthem and how it's very much contested, and what's happened in Canada with O Canada over the past decade or so. There have been episodes where people have been charged with being disloyal for not being willing to stand up and sing the anthem in certain circumstances, and other people have been charged with being undemocratic for arguing that people should be forced to stand and sing the anthem. So I think that's certainly a commonality between Canada and the United States.
And then in recent years, one of the lyrics were changed, right? In our anthem, so, inspired a great discussion as to whether it should or shouldn't.
Exactly. And I think one of the interesting things about O Canada is that it's a long, long process by which O Canada finally gets adopted as an official anthem. I mean, it's sung unofficially for about 100 100 years before it's officially proclaimed an anthem in 1980. And a lot of that has to do with, the tune was pretty much set back in the 1880s. But the hard part was trying to find English Canadian, or English lyrics that were acceptable to enough people, and trying to find a consensus around that. And for me, that strikes me as sort of a fitting metaphor for Canada as a country, in that it was, it was a slow process by which it attained full independence, slow to take on its own foreign policy, and then slow to adopt its own official anthem.
Yeah, and they're trying to find the right words. I mean, isn't that the problem of life? The thing that annoys me about the anthem is, if anything, is that one of the lines repeats.
Yes, and in fact, that was a constant complaint throughout the 20th century, was that people were being told to stand on guard far too often over the course of the song.
that takes us to the Mountie, which is a fascinating image, because for a lot of people, I think Hollywood took it on, in those Nelson Eddy, Jeanette MacDonald films, and viewed Canada in that light. The idea of peace, order, and good government, the Mountie plays a big part in that. You wrote that essay in the book, I understand.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. What has that? I don't know if our reverence is the right word, but our recognition of the Mountie as a symbol in this country. I mean, the RCMP goes through over the years. A lot of controversy in the sort. Does our allegiance to it say? Does that hold throughout history?
I think it does for the most part. I think there's an interesting shift in terms of the symbolism of the Mountie. So I think I'm fairly comfortable saying that the Mountie remains a popular reference point for and celebration of English Canadian identity from the formation of the Northwest Mounted Police in the 1870s. Right through the course of the 20th century. But what changes, of course, is English-Canadian identity changes a fair amount from the 19th century to the present day. Mm-hmm. And so what happens with the image of the Mountie is that it sort of has to catch up with what English-Canadians are thinking about themselves. So in the late 19th century, representations of the Mountie would have focused on his Britishness, on his individual achievement, and on his ability to suppress Indigenous peoples. By the 1960s and 1970s, that's not really how most English Canadians want to see themselves, and so in terms of popular depictions, there's a shift towards focusing on the Mountie as sort of a collectivist organization, one that focuses on multiculturalism and where it can, one that focuses on moments where it enjoyed a fairly good relationship with Indigenous peoples. And so that sort of update happens in the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s. And that, I think what happens there is that allows the Mountie to retain its place as a symbol of English-Canadian identity. Now, as you've noted, over the past 10, 15 years, there's been a series of controversies and scandals with the RCMP. And I think what we're seeing now is that over the course of the 20th century, that symbolism, the popular symbolism, worked in favor and probably protected the reputation of the RCMP somewhat because of the reverence directed towards the symbolism. I think there's been sort of a critical mass of negative publicity over the last 10 or 15 years that's rendered the symbolism probably less ability to shield the RCMP from critical commentary.
You mentioned Kaepernick earlier. I think on this continent, at least, there was a rise up or a skepticism towards authority in general. That the Mountie, I think, was rendered, say, not immune to that sort of criticism.
Yes, yeah, I think you're right, and I think you can see that even in the 1960s, mm-hmm. right, in terms of protests, yeah. And that sort of thing. That would be a more general challenging of authority figures, right? And I think the part of that updating of the Mountie image was designed to deal with that kind of pressure and that kind of protest. And I think it worked it worked reasonably well for about 15, 20 years into the 1990s. And I think now perhaps it's less effective in sort of shielding the RCMP from criticism.
So some of the symbols that you that are featured in the book are problematic, and especially when we talk in the context of, say, appropriation of native culture, the canoe and the totem pole come to mind. On the front cover of the book, I just noticed this, the totem pole has a price tag, and so,
yes.
So the commodification of these symbols, I mean, that obviously upsets a lot of people.
Absolutely, absolutely, and it's one of the themes that we wanted to weave throughout the book. So, you know, we tried to make the chapters as short and as engaging as possible. There's all sorts of, I think there's about 200 images throughout the book, but at the same time, we asked the authors to weave through important themes, and one is certainly, you know, Canada's history of colonialism and issues surrounding appropriation, and the totem pole, I think, is it's one of my favorite chapters in the book because it's so filled with irony. Mm-hmm. Given that, you know, the federal government starts to take a real interest in defining the totem pole as something that's quintessentially Canadian in the 1920s, and in fact, one of the arguments put forward is that the totem pole is quintessentially Canadian because it combines Indigenous culture with European know-how and technology in terms of carving and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But at the exact moment that one arm of the federal government is championing that idea of the totem pole as being Canadian, another arm of the federal government, through Indian agents, is out west suppressing indigenous cultures, banning the potlatch, for example, which is a ceremony that's pretty much necessary to be in order to secure the resources to erect a totem pole. So there's a really quite a rich irony there with in terms of the story of how the totem pole comes to be seen as Canadian.
Yeah. The other thing that this book provokes is debate amongst people that read it in terms of what's a symbol and what might not be. When I saw the list and I saw that Tim Hortons was on there, I doubted that. And then, you know, you read the essay, and then you think of your own personal experience. I mean, when I see news reports of it, you know, opening up in other parts of the world, especially, you know, in Afghanistan during the conflict there.
Right.
I remember I saw it somewhere in the States once, and I actually got excited of seeing it, even though I don't really consume the products that they have. I mean, I live in Vancouver, and those of us that live, say, in big cities in this country tend to go to, you know, there are other places to get coffee or donuts or snacks. A lot of people look at the company and its sort of decline in the market, and I'm wondering if that has anything to do with how it will be viewed as a symbol, say, going forward.
Sure, yeah. Good question. Yeah, I think the interesting thing about Tim Hortons, and I think one of the reasons it ended up in the book, is it's an example a bit like the national anthem, of an entity that has drawn on other symbols and then become a symbol itself, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we think about the Tim Hortons commercials over the past 15, 20 years, there's always a focus on small towns, there's a focus on the north, on hockey, all of these, you know, other sort of symbols of Canadian life. And yet, as you say, you know, when people go overseas, if they're in the United States and they see a Tim Hortons, or there's always chatter about coming back and people being excited to have their first Tim Hortons or their first donut that they haven't had for a while or something like that. So we thought Tim Hortons was interesting because of that dynamic, you know, a symbol that draws on other symbols. But we also thought it was interesting for exactly the point you've made, that, you know, wrapping oneself or wrapping one's company in a national flag, you know, comes with expectations. And so if you start to underperform, if you start to receive less than positive reviews for the quality of the coffee or the service, mm-hmm. You know, there's probably a bigger price to pay. Because there's this expectation that you're carrying the weight of the nation with you.
And it's become such a part of the vernacular. I mean, we were talking in the office a couple weeks ago. Someone was going to go get donuts from another place. And I said, well, I don't feel like a donut. I feel like the holes, you know, which is what that other place calls them. And then someone corrected me and said, no, they're called Timbits. And I said, well, no, not at that place. And then, you know, double in terms of what's in the coffee and the sort. I mean, that's just, you know, permeated our vernacular, as I said a moment ago.
Yeah, that's absolutely. And one of the more interesting documents we came across for that chapter was it was basically a guidebook for new immigrants, and one that was distributed to Syrian refugees. And it had, you know, how to learn key phrases in English, and it used Tim Hortons as an example. So it actually had a page or two that taught people how to purchase coffee and donuts specifically at a Tim Hortons, telling them what a double-double actually meant and that sort of thing.
Now, I'm talking to you for you're in the East Coast. You write in the book about, there's an essay in the book about Anne of Green Gables, and I'm wondering, is that more of an Eastern Canadian thing?
Yeah, I think so. Anne's interesting in the sense that I think, you know, I would think most Canadians not from the Maritime region would certainly view Anne of Green Gables as a regional symbol, as a mm-hmm. representation of Atlantic Canada, small town, green fields, that sort of thing. But it's also interesting, I think, that people outside of Canada probably don't focus on that regional representation. I think that they tend to see Anne as a typically Canadian figure, And one of the interesting things we realized in terms of writing that chapter was that there were people in various parts of the world that had a very close connection and really identified with Anne as a character. And I was familiar with the fact that Japanese tourists are often keen to come to PEI and visit the Green Gables site. Mm. But Poland, during the Second World War, there were members of the Polish underground, the resistance, that saw in Anne of Green Gables a very plucky and inspiring figure. And then even after the Second World War, under the communists looked to ban all sorts of books. But there were many Poles that had formed this bond with the figure of Anne and did their best to hold on to copies and distribute them secretly amongst one another because they identified with the character. So I think Anne of Green Gables works as both a regional symbol and a national symbol, but also clearly there are people outside of Canada that identify with her, even though they have no connection to the actual place where the story is set.
Yeah, that's what a lot of the symbols, and I guess that's why I found reading the book where I disagreed, say, as to what a symbol might be, was that it didn't apply to me, but I think it's how other people viewed Canada or Canadians. And
right,
I guess I lose sight of that because I live in the country, right?
Yeah, no, I think you're right, and that's, we've got about, 22, 23 symbols in the book, and I think you're right. There are some people that are going to have a closer connection with some symbols rather than others, and I think what we were hoping with the book is that, there'll be people that are interested in diving into, some chapters more than others because they're already interested in learning a little bit more about the anthem or the flag or maple syrup. And then other folks will be interested in reading straight through, reading more than one chapter in a single sitting, and start to see some of the patterns and some of the connections between the symbols as well.
Yeah. So the book is edited by you, Catherine Gidney, and Donald Wright. How did the three of you, as you're putting the book together, find the contributors that contribute the essays in the book?
Right. So originally, Catherine and I came up with the idea of doing this book. We were inspired by a book called Symbols of Australia that we read that told us all sorts of interesting tales about the shark and the kangaroo and the mm-hmm. Sydney Opera House. And we thought, wouldn't it be fun to do something similar for Canada? And then we quickly realized this was a task too big for the two of us. And so we asked Don, and he was more than willing and excited to come on board. And then we had a couple of meetings, and then we all looked at each other and said, "Nah, this is too big for the three of us." So we started knocking on doors. We knew that some people already had expertise and were already working on some of these topics. And then for others, we just went with people that we thought might have the time and the inclination and might be excited about exploring some of these topics. And so all of them were historians, and we had them do drafts and discuss the drafts and workshop them, and then set to the task of finding the appropriate photographs to go with the various chapters, and had some fun with that.
Yeah, that's what makes the book as enjoyable as it does, because I mean the essays are awfully thought provoking and interesting, but when you see the symbols themselves in various depictions, historically and otherwise, it just adds literally color to what one has read in the book.
Right. Yeah. No, I can appreciate that. You think about these symbols they work at such a visual level, right? They permeate everyday life. They're on television. They're on T-shirts. They're in textbooks, statues. They're everywhere, right? And I think that's one of the things we tried to get at with the book, using all the images.
So it said in your bio that one of your goals later is to write a book about the Muppets.
Yes. 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 That will be a dream come true. Yeah. I grew up in the 1970s watching the Muppets on TV on Sunday evenings, I think it was, and then once I started, launched into a historical career and got interested in popular culture, I've been thinking about this for a while. They were fun, they were entertaining, but there were also some pretty interesting, and I think quite subversive, political messages going on there. We were talking earlier about challenges to authority, and if you think about some of the sketches, they were challenging the authority of the medical profession, with Rolf the dog trying to operate, and not too effectively, and and making fun of the media through through the Muppet news flashes that were always kind of crazy. So there's some interesting academic work on the Muppets, and I'd be keen if I could find the time to draw on that, sit down with my kids and watch all those episodes again, and maybe try and come up with a popular book that sort of explores, you know, the political significance of the Muppets, but in a fun way, I think.
Yeah, people think of variety shows and think of Jackie Gleason or Carol Burnett, which are obviously very good examples of variety shows. But I mean, the Muppet Show itself, you know, with guest stars and the sort. I mean, that's some of the best variety television, you know, right up there with, say, Ed Sullivan, even.
Oh yeah, the list of people that ended up on that show, from real live people to fictional characters from other shows and movies. And I think my favorite, I think, is that I've seen recently, anyways, was Elton John performing on the show, and of course Sam Eagle being the great protector of American morality was outraged to see him there at his flamboyant best. And that's, again, one of those interesting tensions that's there on the show. I think we're all supposed to sort of nod in agreement that Sam is supposed to feel uncomfortable because we're on side with Elton John.
Yeah. Well, back to Symbols of Canada for just a second. I mean, what I enjoyed reading the book, and what I got out of it is one realizes just how remarkable the country is. I mean, it is maddening, it is annoying, and but at the same time, you know, these symbols make us realize just how special and in some instances how good the country is.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. I think you have to see Canada as a work in progress. And in terms of what we'd like people to get out of the book, you know, we'd like them to be entertained by it. We'd like them to be informed by it. I think they'll learn interesting things. But also, I think ideally, they'll be able to read about these symbols, learn something about how other people across the country might view these symbols, recognize that there are different opinions about these symbols and thus about the history that informs them. And I think that the more we can be aware of what other people are thinking about these symbols and about Canada and its history, the better conversations we're going to be able to have about where Canada's at right now and where ideally it's going to go in the future.
Absolutely. And Michael, I so enjoyed the book and appreciate your time and that you took in taking to talk about it. Thanks for this.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
The book is called Symbols of Canada. It's published by Between the Lines. One of its editors, Michael Dawson, joined me on the line from Fredericton, New Brunswick, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.